always as simple as using your cell phone. That's why now is the time to take action. Go to ready.gov/communicate and make your emergency plan today. Don't wait. Communicate. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council. KPFT Houston.
Clouds below your knees. Signals 8 p.m. Thursday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's right here on Houston Community Radio, KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm your host, Mary Edgerton, along with an ensemble of gifted hosts. Hank Rubichak, our producer and the show's founder, Greg Audell, appearing with Floyd the Wonder Dog, Warren Holloman, our master of wellness, Harwood Taylor and Chris Gorman, Eric Heen, Paul Topikian, and Tatiana Gago, our former intern. Through storytelling, we take our listeners on fantastic journeys to faraway places before delivering them safely back in the present. Tonight, I have chosen a place special to my heart for our destination, Rio Grande City, Texas. It is where I grew up. Rio Grande City is about halfway between Brownsville and Laredo, right on the Rio Grande River. I have drawn from descriptions from the National Park Service website and from Wikipedia to describe the history of Rio Grande City. It is one of the oldest towns in the lower Rio Grande region, and the Rio Grande City downtown district contains the most concentrated and intact collection of historic buildings in the area, with a collection of commercial, domestic, and combined commercial-domestic buildings dating from its earliest period of development, about 1840 to about 1940. Rio Grande City has a long and colorful history dating from its 18th century origins as a Spanish land grant to its place in the Mexican and American Civil Wars and up through the first half of the 20th century. As isolated as it was, the city boasted a cosmopolitan business population of Spanish, Mexican, German, French, Swiss, and Anglo-American residents over this period. The initial land grant was given to José Adaño de la Garza Falcón in 1767. These land grants, called porciones, span the Rio Grande from north to south because at the time, Texas was under Spanish control. Early on, most of the settlements were on the south side of the river in what is now Mexico. Around 1747 to 1749, the Spanish colonizer José de Escandón began to create a settlement on the north side of the river in what is now the United States. When Stephen F. Austin brought settlers from the then western part of the U.S., mostly Tennessee and Kentucky, a young Kentuckian named Henry Clay Davis came to Rio Grande City in the 1830s. The legend is that he fell in love with Hilaria de la Garza, a descendant of José Antonio de la Garza. The area was known as Davis Landing, and it became an important port for steamboats along the Rio Grande. Davis built a lovely house facing where the river ran at the time. One story was that he built it so that he could look across to Mexico where his beloved Hilaria lived. Another story, I think probably the true story, because he built the house after he married, was that Hilaria wanted to look across the river to where her family lived. It was a beautiful house with a wonderful balcony facing out to what was then called River Street. I visited it many times. Unfortunately, when I was looking for it just recently, I found out that it was demolished in 1995. A tragic loss. Texas declared independence from Mexico in 1836 and remained an independent country until it voted for annexation by the U.S. in 1845. The Mexican-American War lasted from 1846 to 1848, in which the border of Texas was contested. During that time, Fort Ringgold was set up in Rio Grande City as a defense against Mexico. It was operational for most of the time from 1848 to 1947. Sometime after that, it was purchased by the Rio Grande City Independent School District to use as a school site. The buildings, dating back to the 1860s, became classrooms. As for Rio Grande City, from its founding in about 1848 to until the Texas-Mexican Railroad opened up in 1883, Rio Grande City, or Davis Landing, was one of the most significant hubs of trade between Texas and Mexico. It was a prosperous steamboat port. As modes of travel changed and as the Rio Grande River shifted further south, it morphed into a farming community, raising crops of tomatoes, onions, and its most important crop, cantaloupe, along with watermelon and honeydew. In the 1960s, it was the third poorest county in the U.S. In 1967, the Texas Farm Worker Strike, led by Eugene Nelson, a follower and colleague of Cesar Chavez, was centered there. In the 1970s and into the 1980s, federal law enforcement concentrated their anti-smuggling efforts on Rio Grande City. So now let's go back to the 1960s when my guest and I were growing up there. There was no library. The movie theater closed down in 1963. There was no swimming pool. The schools were not air conditioned. There were a lot of historical buildings. There were only a handful, I say maybe three, restaurants where women and children would be welcomed in a family setting. A large portion of the population were migrant farm workers, and they received welfare food during the winter. So now that you are safely settled in Rio Grande City, hot, dusty, semi-arid, with 17 inches of rainfall annually, and summer temperatures well into the 100s, let me introduce you to Marcia Power. She and I will tag team to create the world that we grew up in. I have a special guest tonight, a fantastic woman, a businesswoman, a storyteller, and someone that, believe it or not, I have known for about 60 years. Growing up, Marcia Power lived a few blocks away. She was the head twirler in high school and freshman class president. Our hometown, Rio Grande City, sits on the Rio Grande River about halfway between Brownsville and Laredo. As you will hear, it has quite a history with respect to international commerce, including smuggling. But let's start first with hearing a little bit about Marcia and how the Power family came to Rio Grande City. Marcia, welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here, Mary. And yes, my mother was in Donna, Texas. Her father was a Baptist preacher there. And my dad moved to the Valley during the Depression to be in the produce business and working on melon sheds, actually, and met my mother at church. And we worked in the produce business for quite a while. They moved to Rio Grande City and opened up the Catfish Inn, which was a bar and restaurant. I grew up in the restaurant. Part of it was built in 1890s, and the other part was built about 1908. It was a bar and restaurant when I lived there, but originally it was a mercantile. My mother sent me to a lady to take history lessons in Rio Grande City, Mrs. Scott. And she knew that I didn't want to be there and asked me to just go ahead and sit down and wait for my mom. So I did. After a couple of visits, she showed me a map and showed me where I lived and asked me if I knew what was right behind it, which I did not. It was a river. And I said, the river's not there. And so she said, but it was. And therefore, she engaged me in Texas and Mexican history. She knew a lot about the buildings in Rio Grande City, which was really cool. Underneath the building that I grew up in was a tunnel that connected to other buildings in town and went all the way to the river. It was used different times for different things. Smuggling is one of them. Tequila, I'm sure, different types of drugs and guns later.
Wow. That's a great start to an introduction to River Indy City, isn't it? Yes, I remember the Catfish Inn because several years ago I had my 50th birthday party in Rio Grande City, and I arranged for some tours of the town. So our tour guide told us that there were smuggling tunnels under the Catfish Inn. That was Mauro Villarreal. You remember him?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, he did quite a bit.
There were a lot of stories, and many of them true. The ghost stories were also true, as I witnessed as a child. I was a crystal child. My mother was indigo. And what that means is they started being born around 1900, indigo children. And they are basically recycled souls, if you will, that made an agreement to come back to Earth and make things better. We typically are very loving and giving and are a peaceful lot. They're easily recognized, usually by their eyes, and they're quite large and usually pretty light. And growing up there in that older building, there were ghosts in that building, and I did communicate with them as a child. It's not something that you say to everybody, as I learned, being called a bruja and different things. When I would talk to people about their aura and what color they were today, I learned to shut off the, basically it's the third eye is the place that you connect and see all these things. And many people have it. It's a gift. And we just don't usually talk about it because of the ridicule and things that came after we would say certain things. So I learned how to shut it off. And then I moved to Austin, Texas, and met some people like myself. And that really did enlighten me. But I wanted to see the auras again. And I couldn't. And I've learned later to meditate and to find a different place within my own self that is very peaceful and loving. And that connected me.
Wow. So, you know, I had my numbers run by somebody and they told me that my karma was zero. So I don't have to come back, which I think is kind of fun. Like I can do anything now and I don't have to come back and make up for it.
No, that's true. It's up to the individual to decide what they think. When you are crystal, you make an agreement to come into this life and you can't remember all the other lifetimes. It's absolutely erased. But generally, we come, they call that group of people star children. And we come to make peace and equality and things like that. Generally, we are in business. Most often, we're called attention deficit and, creative. But it all comes from, I think, why we came back to do good and to do service.
So tell me a little bit about the ghosts. What were they like?
At the Catfish Inn, I started living there when I was five, and I would start seeing these little things that looked like maybe a sheet that was transparent. And they would start talking to me. It wasn't scary. It was more like conversation. And I just thought they were my playmates. I was an only child. And, then later on, we had a maid and she didn't, it would scare her. So my mom talked to me and just said, stop playing with those people. I think she knew. My mother was what's called an indigo. She was the first one to come. She was born in 1918 of my family. And so she kind of guided me through some of these things on how to get through being a child that could see other dimensions, if you will.
Wow. So, my house was pretty scary. I guess you lived on Main Street, First Street, and I lived almost exactly two blocks over on 2nd Street.
Yes.
And our house was built in 1895. It was designed by a protege of Heinrich, later known as Enrique Portscheller. So it's known as a Portscheller house. And he came from Germany in the 19th century, where he had gone AWOL during one of the Central European Wars. He came to live with a branch of his family who had a construction business in Mexico, and he designed houses up and down the valley. They're known for the motifs that are built into the front brickwork in the front of the house. So ours has an Aztec design with the point on top, and you'll see there's a pattern of brickwork across the top. Now, I was afraid of ghosts in our house while I was growing up, especially after my father told me that my great-grandfather had hidden a murderer in the house. And then the stairs used to creak, and it was as though if a creak began at the bottom of the stairs, then the stairs would stretch and creak all the way up to the top. And I would look over to see who would come up the stairs, and there would be nobody there. So for a long time, I wouldn't even sleep upstairs by myself. Our family lived upstairs while I was little, and as I got older, my parents moved downstairs, and I was supposed to stay upstairs by myself, and I was absolutely terrified. I was well into my teens. But tell me again about how you met Mrs. Scott. Your mother was looking for things to do, for you to do.
Well, yes, I there wasn't much for us to do in Rio Grande City. After school and on weekends and things like that. And she sent me to play piano, but I didn't do too well with the little chopsticks. And then I took tap. And then she sent me to see Mrs. Scott. And I studied with her about, I know, 3 summers or 3 school years. And I'd go once a week, and she'd tell me the different stories about the buildings and the history and the fort. And I fell in love with the fort and certainly with the buildings. Later on, probably 15 years ago, I started a Facebook group for the Fort Ringo called Friends of Fort Ringo. Later, there were two local groups started their own, which is great. The more the merrier to have paying attention to the fort, which was our school. I went to school in on the fort from first grade to when I finished high school. And it's known to have ghosts there, but I never had any experience with that at the school.
I remember the school. So I went to the convent school across town. It's not a very big town. Until 8th grade, and then I went to high school in the fort. I do remember my dad asked me if I wanted to quit the convent school. He really didn't like organized religion, but I was afraid of going to the public school because I heard that there was lots of fighting, that there were that it was rough. Did you have a rough time?
I did. I was beat up the first my first day in first grade by 2 sisters, and I was not a fighter by nature, but it was difficult being a different color of person in a community that was 97% Hispanic, and I did get in fights, and I did learn how to fight. I'm not proud of that. I just think it was part of my survival there. Later on, I had in high school, we'd gone to California, and I ran into a friend from the valley, from Rio Grande City, that was stranded, and I loaned her some money, and then she got back home, and then when we got to high school, she told me, I'm going to fight for you, you don't have to fight anymore, and that was when I think I was a freshman when that happened, and I was so glad, because I was always taller and bigger than everybody else. And I don't mean I beat the pulp out of anybody. It was, some kind of hitting and yelling and stuff like that. But it was, I was so glad that I didn't have to participate in that, nor have I since then. Thank God.
I mean, I do remember that. There was something about having to prove yourself. Not many outsiders ventured into Rio Grande City.
Nope.
So if you ventured in, you had to prove yourself. In fact, one night, and the boys still remember this, you know, we didn't have, the movie theater closed down when I was seven, and our family didn't have television. So I would read movie reviews and just dream about seeing these movies one day. And we did have the drive-in. So, and the movies would come maybe 2 years after they'd come out and circulate. Mm-hmm. So the movie Marooned had come out maybe when I was in eighth grade, and then I was in high school and it came to the drive-in and I wanted to see it so badly. So I made a deal with my brother, you know, I'll take out the garbage for the next 3 weeks if you will take me to see Marooned, you know. Since I was stuck at home and I was a girl, my father didn't let me out. My brother had a driver's license, so he could pretty much, you know, manipulate the deal to get what he wanted. So he and his buddies, Mike, James, and
Stevie Gonzalez,
we all went to the drive-in together. And I was just so excited. You know, I have the speaker up. I'm listening to the movie. The boys got out of the car and they were smoking cigarettes, which they weren't supposed to do because they were teenagers. So they were feeling pretty pumped. And so then, all of a sudden, they jump back in the truck and they put the speaker outside and they roll up the windows and lock the doors. And I said, what are you doing? What are you doing? You know, I'm in the middle of this movie. And they said, no, we're going to have to go. And I said, why do we have to go? They said, because the San Mon gang is here and they just parked next to us. And I was like, No, I have made a deal and I have waited for this movie for 2 years and I'm here to see it. And I am going to see this movie. And so they said, well, you know, the San Mon gang is pretty rough. And I said, well, I'll fight him myself. Well, the guy said, no. So they went out and they met the San Mon gang outside. I put the speaker back in the car and was losing the truck. And the deal they made was that one guy from the San Mon gang and one guy from the truck would put their forearms together against each other. And somebody would drop a lighted cigarette there in between two of them. And the first one who flinched was the loser. So those guys, I mean, still to this day, will tell me, they'll point to their scars and say, I did this for you. I mean, it was a town where you had to prove, you know, there was a kind of machismo thing and you had to prove yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And being a girl and I was an only child, so I didn't have any brothers to protect me. I had to learn how to take care of myself in that kind of city. I mean, I am very grateful that I grew up in Rugani City. It made me bilingual, bicultural. I fell in love with the love that the Mexican-American families had for each other. I think they're exemplary. They show a lot of kindness and love, and we could all do better with that. I do think that, you know, because of the proximity, being 50 miles away, basically, from the police force, which when they would come to town to arrest somebody in the 60s, basically 70s, 80s, everybody would know when they were coming. I mean, not that I was smuggling pot or any of that kind of stuff, but, you know, there were CB radios and there was warnings. And then by the time they get to our little town, everything had already been cleaned up. And then they would send the uniformed troopers and different types of policing. And they were generally white, and that stuck out in our county. You know who they were. You knew what kind of cars they had. They had black tires and CB radio antennas. They were very identifiable. So it made it hard to police and control the drug trafficking that was coming across the border through Star County. And then the Armadillo gang was a gang in the 60s, and they were basically good boys, are football players, and they came up to Austin and they started running pot and labeling it by grade. So one armadillo was the worst and five armadillos was the best. And when I got up here, I had people that knew some of those guys, and I knew who they were, but they were older and certainly their names don't matter. But it was confirmed by one of them to me, and we had lunch and we enjoyed it. But there's, you know, it's still an interesting place. Lots of lots of love and lots of people are trying to do their best, but the crime situation isn't any better today. It's just different. It's not pot. It's just, I don't think I would feel too safe going there by myself right now, probably because of my opinions, and I've been pretty vocal on some of their local Facebook groups to protect the fort. I think the fort is the main reason that I have issues with Rio Grande City not taking care of it, because I loved it so much, and it's such an important part of our history, and it's so beautiful. There's about 45 buildings there, and they're in such disrepair, and it's a daunting task for the school that owns it. I mean, our school district owns it. And it needs a lot of repair. But the community is now, I think, rallying, and it's getting attention. It's got some champions and some leadership in that area. And I'm really proud that they're moving that forward.
Yeah, I tried to go in. I was just there recently, and I tried to drive into the fort, but it used to be that anybody could drive onto school grounds, but that is not the case anymore anywhere.
Yes, and there's an exceptional museum there. It's really a very good museum, very well done. It's the Robert E. Lee Museum. And it's, you know, that name in itself brings up a lot of things for a lot of people, pro and con. But nobody can see all of the stuff that that little museum has because it's shut down. I would like them to change the name of the museum, but I don't think that the locals agree with me, and I'm certainly not in charge of it.
Right. I think it's based on the fact that he came down when he was actually a United States general and oversaw trial or something. And so it's not even really honoring him as a Confederate general.
It's not. And if a person, you know, you can get into the museum by making a reservation. And if anybody's in the area, I think it'd be kind of cool to even tour the walk around the fort, which I think you can. Now, you might get run off, which they've tried to run me off, but I walk it and just take pictures because I love it. They have a lot of birds and butterflies. It's a wonderful place to take a walk.
Yeah, it is. And actually, I remember it's right on the river because the boys took me down to the river one time just to show me. Yeah, it's really there. You can get to it. So, yes, one time I did walk to the river. I mean, that was a kind of an advantageous thing about being a girl growing up in Rio Grande City with a father who had very strict rules for me, but having a brother who, if I knew enough about him, I could have him, you know, hey, you're going down to the river, I'm going with you, you know. So, although I did do a lot of taking out of the garbage lately. Now we're going to step out of Rio Grande City and take a break for station identification. So we are here on So What's Your Story, broadcast live every Thursday at 8 p.m. at KPFT 90.1 FM Houston Community Radio. Now, wait a minute. I always like to say broadcast live, but let's say near live. We have to record in advance because of everything that's going on, from the pandemic to the repair on the antenna. But let me say that we look forward to our weekly show and the opportunity to be an important part of the Houston storytelling scene. So, let me put on my social media hat and say something about our show. If you don't have a radio, it's no excuse for missing it because you can listen to us. You can listen to us live streaming on kpft.org. Check us out on our Facebook page, So What's Your Story, and tell us what you think about our shows or suggest program ideas by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page and leaving us a message. We promise to get back to you. And please be sure to share our page with friends and please like us before you leave. Even in this pandemic, there are other storytelling venues in and around town. Let's start with the Houston Storytellers Guild. Join them because this is the best group to work with to start cultivating your storytelling talent. They are monthly story swaps that are held on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. are currently virtual, and you can find out how to log into their Zoom meetings at HoustonStorytellers.org. That's one word, HoustonStorytellers.org, for upcoming events. And while you're there, you can check out all our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008 listed on the menu under radio program. Now, don't miss our friends at The Moth, who also are hosting virtual events. I believe the next one that is advertised will be on May 25th. There are many others posted on their website, occurring at various different time zones around the United States and around the world. So check these out. Buy tickets, because they do sell out. And don't forget to tune in again here next Thursday at 8 p.m. on KPFT 90.1 Houston Community Radio for the next edition of So What's Your Story? Now, let's get back to this sleepy little town on the border, known for its international commerce, both legal and illegal. But it is true that it seemed a more innocent time when it was marijuana being smuggled. And it was after that, the harder drugs, the cocaine and heroin, after the Miami drug routes were cut off, and then came the cartels. And the violence across the river has really been tragic, because we used to go there to eat there. And to
buy fruit. We would drive across to get avocados and tortillas and, you know, go have lunch. And, you know, we grew up with a lovely border. And of course, now there's other issues with the children coming over, which is, you know, that's something that the Valley's having to deal with. And I think they are. There's a wonderful nun that's been taking care of them for decades, Sister Norma. I think she's in either Mission or McAllen. And she does take donations.
Yeah, it's quite a situation. Although when we were there growing up, the border, people went back and forth across all the time and stayed, and then you didn't need a passport to go across the river. And I think it costs about a nickel. So, how about you? When you graduated from high school, you went to college at Pan Am?
I did for 2 years, and then I went to barber school in Corpus Christi. From there, I moved to Victoria for a couple of years, and then I found my home in Austin. I worked here about 7 years and then opened up my own salon. And 3.5 years ago, I opened up the second location. We have 35 lovely employees. It's my pleasure to work with them, to work for them, to give them a place where they can find work balance. And they are my family. I never had any children, and these people are my heart and soul, and it's my honor to serve them.
Oh, that's great. Now, there's a great story about the opening night party.
Yes, a friend of mine lived in New York City, and she owned a limousine business, and her two main clients were Greta Garbo and Liza Minnelli. So at our opening sometime in 1986, she had Greta Garbo call me. And oh my gosh, I thought I was going to have a heart attack. So I went into the massage room and I said, oh, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. And I said, we're having your birthday party. And she said, why? And I said, because I love you. I named my business after you. And that part's not exactly true, but I did like the name Garbo. A friend of mine that's an actress offered that name. C.K. McFarland in Austin, Texas, gave us Garbo. And then later on, I learned about her. She was the first woman to be paid equal to a man in the film industry. And that's because she walked off set for 2 years. Her male counterpart, I think it was Gilbert was his last name. He was getting paid $5,000 a week, and she was getting paid $500. So the more I learned about her, in fact, she started out as a shampoo girl. The more I learned about her, the more I felt connected to her. But yeah, it was delightful to talk to her. For me, she was totally not engaged, but that's okay. You gave me a story.
Yeah. Hey, that's enough. I would have loved to have spoken to Greta Garbo.
Yes.
So your salon has really gotten to be known really.
Yes. Well, we're honored by, there's a industry award that they give out every year. It's called Top 200. It's by Salon Today magazine. And we've been able to get that award the last 9 years, including 2020, for philanthropy. So that one I'm the most proud of. The other ones are kind of numbers and what you do for your community and things like that, and what we do for the employees. So I'm really honored by that, and it's a big award. We've also gotten Best Of in Austin. We actually tied with another salon a few years ago, and City Search, we got Best Spa. We actually only have one little room, but we had some really great estheticians that worked for us at the time. So it's quite a joy. I still work a few days a week. I work a lot offsite managing the business, and I have a wonderful crystal child himself, Jonathan Jones, who has a master's in business, and he's the director of the company, and he is significant to keeping our success going and thriving. It's been a little difficult, to say the least, through the pandemic, because, of course, no income was coming in. We were able to get the PPP money the first round, which we were one of 13% of the people that applied got it. And because of Jonathan, we were able to get that early on. And then we got the second round, which kept us going, paying our payroll and rent. And so now we're able to stand on our own. And I'm very grateful. I mean, for the federal government did a great service to small businesses. And now it's up to us to keep it going.
That's great. That's great. Do you have anything to say to anybody, like a woman starting in business, or what men can learn from women?
Well, I think that it's listening. I think sometimes, you know, I'm a female leader, so I'm more often called a bitch than a boss, and men tend to be the boss. And the two things that that has in common is they both start with a B, actually, because I think men can learn that to listen. Most of the time what women's issues are is that they're tired and exhausted and being taxed and pulled from so many sides, and then they get to work and it's kind of a refuge for them. It's a safe place, and they're able to thrive at work. And I think men need to see that with women, that sometimes our work is very important, if not, you know, the highlight of our day. I don't have children, so I'm sure mothers might think that their children are, and I can respect that. I was honored by having a beautiful mother that treated me like I was, you know, a gift from God, and she was a lovely person. Back to Rio Grande City, my mother, we had some bar maids that were working for us on the bar side, and my mother found out that a couple of them were actually prostituting. And so the restaurant was always closed on Sunday. So my mother decided to start inviting them to have lunch with us. And at my house, that was called dinner. Your last meal was supper and your middle meal was dinner. So she invited all five of the women that worked for us to start coming to have dinner with us. And my father was like, I work with these people 6 days a week. I need a break. And my mother was relentless. So she served and treated them like ladies. And she gained a lot of respect for them. And some of their lives really did change because of my mother. And I grew up as her as my example and a beacon on how to treat people. And she, being a Baptist preacher's daughter, she sat me down every day of my life with my mother. And there was a story, generally about Jesus, and it could last a minute, it could last an hour. And I learned to love those stories. And then that's what she wanted me to emulate, was being good and kindness and love. And back to the crystal children, that's who we are. We came here for that. We came here to exude that in this lifetime and hopefully make a difference. I hope I make a difference at work, and I hope I make a difference in life.
Well, you know, Marcia, that's a beautiful story, because I think that tells something about you and your mother, who both came through with Indigo Child, mother of a crystal child. But to be so open to so many different kinds of people and not to judge them. And I see you coming from Rio Grande City and then going to Austin and being able to move across cultures and open arms to everybody because you're not judging them. And it sounds like your mother was that type of person also.
Oh, that's what she taught and that's how she lived, as well as being the receiver of prejudice because of being colorless. You know, it made me sensitive to not be like that, not look at people because of those things. And, you know, I'm a real fan of what's going on today as far as the exposure and the transparency and the difficult conversations that we're having with friends and friends of color and friends of other ethnicities. I think that those conversations need to happen for us to shift the consciousness to be better people and to be a better United States.
I absolutely agree. And I'll tell you, I don't know if it's just something special about Rio Grande City, but my father, who had grown up there, was very comfortable with us playing with the kids of the woman who lived on the corner from us, and being in her house and then being at our house. And I found out much later that she had a business as a prostitute when she was younger, and she was managing a house with a couple of girls in it. And he said, you know, he said, I always know you're safe when you're with her. She watches out after her kids. There's nothing going on in her house that's inappropriate. And I feel comfortable with you being at their house. Now, there might be other houses that he wouldn't have said that. And it didn't matter how much the person made or what they did as a living. It was how you lived your life and how
that's
you
true.
Lived other people. And then, of course, people have to understand the context of prostitution in our culture. It was not controlled by organized crime as it is
no.
in the United States. And so
it was survival.
It was survival, right. It was survival,
Survival for those women.
Your family and your kids. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a great lesson that came out of Rio Grande City. And, you know, so many of my friends were migrant farm workers and were on welfare. And I would go to their house to watch television because we didn't have
And I would go to their house to eat the cheese. They got some kind of
that
nice
was
cheese.
And the peanut butter, you remember? It was peanut butter. And you had to start
We all grew up the same. And I love that about that city. I mean, I wish some of that stuff is still the same. And when I go back, I have the same feeling and love. But I do miss that life when we were there. Even hardships and all, they just made me stronger. They made me better. And also, I fell in love with the culture and certainly the food.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. So Mrs. Scott's house is now a restaurant.
Yes.
Casa de Arloba. Have you been to it?
Oh, yes. It's wonderful. I plan on going down Sunday.
Yes. I was just there, I guess. I think it was just last weekend. I took some friends down to see the birds and the native plants and the cactus and so on. All these things that I thought when I was growing up were just too ordinary. And now I realize that the cactus bloom is something very special.
The tuna.
Oh, yes. The tuna. Did you eat tuna?
Call it the tuna?
Yeah, it's called the tuna, that red fruit.
My mother started her own business. She was an entrepreneur, and she packed different kinds of fruits and vegetables and native things from that area. One was she made jelly or jam, actually, out of the tuna, which I think is called prickly pear.
Yes, yes. It's called prickly pear, and I don't know what tuna is in English, actually. I only know the name in Spanish, so the fruit of the prickly pear. And actually, you know, there was another fruit from a cactus called pitaya. Do you remember pitayas? Pitayas are smaller, and they grow out in the countryside, and they taste like a cross between a kiwi and a strawberry.
Ooh.
And in fact, they should be in season in June. I want to go back and try to pick some. And And I've often thought of starting a business, making pitaya jelly, except you really have to go out and harvest it. It's, you know, it's.
Right. Well, like when in the 60s, when the hippies and most more importantly and legally, the Indians came to harvest the peyote that grew in Stark County. And I think it's only one of two places in the United States where it grows or it grew then during those times in the 60s and 70s. Pretty freely. I remember there was some in my mother's garden. I didn't know what it was, but it would just pop up.
Yeah. Yeah. I do remember when some of the shamans from New Mexico would come and
yes,
they would ask my dad, who had grown up there as a little boy, and we would always give him permission to go on our property and pick. And he'd say, okay, this is where it is. He said, but I'll tell you where there used to be a lot of it. How do you know? we were welcoming to them, not so much to the people who would come and harvest it. I don't think they were conscientious.
They weren't using it for religious ceremonies. Remember there were bands of hippies that would come through there?
Yes.
And big buses, you know, they do their buses. So, you know, it was just, it was a very interesting place to grow up. And it was certainly its own little island and made its own rules and laws. And yes, you had to prove yourself. And I'm glad for the strength that I gained from growing up there and the appreciation that I gained for the culture and the community.
Yeah, it's very special. I want to make sure that people know about your Facebook page, Friends of Fort Ringgold, that's right?
Yes,
Yeah.
Yes, Friends of Fort Ringgold. And it's strictly for the history of the fort. We don't get into politics and put too much on there that's about anything else, just about the fort.
Yeah, it is. And it's, you know, when I was growing up, I always thought, oh my God, all these fans, why don't we have air conditioning? Because it would get up to be in the 110s and a little bit, at least.
Oh yeah.
And then, you know, along my life, I'm living in New York and all the fancy restaurants had these ceiling fans. And I was like, so what's so special about a ceiling fan? I grew up with these, you know. and it took me a while to realize what a different experience than we had growing up than people in more affluent areas who had TVs and movie theaters and swimming pools.
Right.
But we had the fort. You had the tunnels.
Yes. Yeah. And I played in them. They are real. And the one behind the Catfish Inn has collapsed. And I don't know what, if any, are functioning right now. Most of the people try to keep it secret, but I would imagine most of them have collapsed since they were made out of bricks.
Yeah.
There were two brick companies in the area. One was in Camargo and the other one was in La Gruya.
I remember the brick plant in La Gruya. Mm-hmm. I remember that. It was up on the top of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Marcia, thank you so much for sharing Rio Grande City and for sharing your early life. I will always remember you as the twirler who was leading the band past our house during a parade. And my brother was outside on the sidewalk. I was upstairs looking out from our balcony, which she had to stand on the beams because there was nothing else but the beams. And you stopped the band and turned around to John and said, hey, you're cute. What's your name?
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. It was probably when we were in junior high because I was a drum major in junior high. I was a twirler in high school.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, my father was completely smitten, and every year when it would be, okay, John, who are you going to invite to the prom? He would say, I think you should invite Marcia Power. I know she's older than you, but, you know, she really is really cute. She has a lot of personality.
Oh, well, I never knew any of that, but I always liked John. He's a wonderful, wonderful person.
Yeah, he's a nice guy, although he did get a lot of garbage duty out of me.
Good for him.
Yeah. Well, I think that ends our night. Marcia, thank you so much for sharing this. A lot of this I didn't know. I didn't know how you had, you were always in Rio Grande City when I was there, so I didn't know how you had gotten there. And thank you for all you do for Fort Ringgold. And I want to say, if you, anybody is in the Austin area, you should check out Garbo's. I'm going to go there. Next time I'm there, I'm going to go for a massage. I'm all for it. So thanks for these wonderful stories and for taking us on a journey of your life. It's been very special. And now don't you dare move, because we have another great KPFT show following us. Yes, coming up next, you'll be loving the very cool Lars and the Tennyson Tapes right here on Houston Community Radio. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary E., and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, and especially our storyteller tonight, Marcia Power, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Yay.
Playing down on the Rio Grande. Out on levee with the full moon above me, my Mexican lady, Lord, how she loved me, down on the Rio Grande. Laughing and singing in the warm night air, loving that woman with the raven hair. We were down on the Rio Grande, strolling with my lover hand in hand. Lord, I'd give anything to be down on the Rio Grande. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Earlier this year, more than 5,000 people gathered online for the first Big Bold Jewish Climate Fest, a five-day festival designed to connect Jewish values with climate action. Lisa Colton produced the festival. She says that for many Jews, climate change has become a moral issue.
When framed as a moral issue, it requires that people get off of the sidelines, that you are either on the right side of history or you're not. And the question is not whether you think this is real or you think it's important. The question is, what are you doing about it?
She says the festival helped people share ideas, motivate one another, and identify climate actions that Jewish leaders can prioritize, such as divesting rabbis' pension funds from fossil fuels.
We heard a lot of leaders, political leaders, Jewish communal leaders, and others articulate their commitment to this issue. And the challenge moving forward will be to hold them to those commitments.
And ensure that the energy and momentum generated during the festival translates into action throughout the year. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
First you listen, then you fall in love. You have your favorite programs that you listen to each and every week. And finally, you do the right thing by calling in that pledge of support to KPFT. You feel great, but guess what? Your job, it's not done just yet. You still need to fulfill your promise to KPFT by sending that pledge payment today. And when you do, you take that often forgotten last step. Don't wait any longer. KPFT depends on you.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We cannot legislate hate out of our people's hearts and minds. We must treat each other with respect and see each other as Americans.
California Congresswoman Young Kim applauded Congress for its bipartisan support of the COVID-19 Hate Crimes Act. The House passed the bill yesterday to create a Justice Department position focusing on anti-Asian hate crimes and strengthening reporting. President Joe Biden is expected to sign the legislation. A House vote is expected today on a commission to investigate the U.S. Capitol attack.
What happened on that fateful day, January 6th? Why it happened? And how do we prevent a violent attack and insurrection that we saw from ever happening again?
Democratic Caucus Chair Hakeem Jeffries notes the commission will be bipartisan and questions opposition from the House Minority Leader.
I don't know what Kevin McCarthy is afraid of.
McCarthy claims the panel would interfere with the federal investigation and said the scope should include other incidents of political violence. Meanwhile, a new report reveals the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Intelligence and Analysis had been given vital intelligence in the run-up to the January 6th riot, but failed to analyze it.
In the last administration, it's my understanding that domestic terrorism was not considered a priority for INA. In fact, that the INA leadership kind of defer to the FBI on that.
That's former Undersecretary at INA, Francis Taylor, who testified before a Senate committee. Now to Michigan, where President Biden took a joyride in an electric pickup truck.
Mr. President!
This sucker's quick.
How does it feel to be behind the wheel, sir?
It feels great.
At a Ford Motors plant in Dearborn, the president promoted his $2.3 trillion tax and spending plan and talked to workers about the need to invest in electric vehicles.
A lot of your friends say, what about the transmission plant? They're not going to have one now. What about this? What about that? But we got to take over the world market. That's what this is about, being the best in the world and be exporting these. That's what we can do if we focus.
Back in D.C., some House Republicans strategized their response to Democratic efforts to raise certain taxes. Minority Whip Steve Scalise accused Democrats of shutting Republicans out of debate.
Tax policy and infrastructure policy should be something that we would work on together as Republicans and Democrats, and that's not where Speaker Pelosi's running this House.
The American Jobs Plan would raise the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28%. It was lowered from 35% in 2017. And a partisan showdown could be looming over mask rules. Several Republicans refused to wear a mask on the House floor Tuesday, despite the threat of a $500 fine. Florida Democratic Congresswoman Val Demings is planning to challenge Republican Senator Marco Rubio in 2022. He was first elected in 2010. Demings served as Orlando's first black female police chief and was considered as a running mate for now President Biden. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
KPFT makes a difference with real people, real stories, and real voices.
I was put in a room where I was hung by my arms. I was couldn't sit down. I couldn't rest all the time with a bag over my head.
Whether it's hearing music that opens your mind or radio that stirs your soul. You know you can count on KPFT to bring you the stories and the people.